We will now conclude by returning to an issue which emerged in our discussion of the history of bioethics as an essential component of the modern understanding of the physician-patient relationship, and which is essential as we move ahead in an era of attempting to provide medical care for larger numbers of individuals, as the social dimensions of medical care and the difficulty in providing care for larger numbers of people in an equitable fashion becomes clearer and clearer. And that's the question of informed consent and the issue of end-of-life care. We've noted that the very significant issue of people directing their own health care, particularly as life reaches its conclusion, is a fundamental part of modern bioethical reflection and also a traditional part of Catholic bioethics. Individuals have the right to determine what kind of procedures, what sort of techniques they wish to have employed, particularly in regard to the amount of burden or pain or finance or expense that these modalities tend to impose. The issue of determining what an individual actually wants is, of course, more complex. Beginning back in the 1960s and 70s, there was a strong effort made to encourage people to fill out what were described as living wills, namely an attempt to anticipate in advance the various things that might happen to an individual and to record one's desires. The difficulties in this practice are multiple. First, very few people can accurately anticipate what will happen to them and weigh and assess the various risks and advantages in accordance with their own desires. This is extremely difficult even for people in the health professions to do. Any kind of a document that would cover all the necessary basis would be so gigantic as to be almost uninterpretable in the context of actual patient care. Sitting down and trying to read it, to understand it, and then to apply it to the individual's circumstance would be an effort in what one might call applied ethical exegesis, of which not very many people would be comfortable or competent to perform. Recognizing this, the shift then moved in the direction of clear designation of someone who could make the decision for a given individual, the idea of designating a proxy or surrogate decision maker. And rather than speaking of a sort of a living will, the shift was towards advance directives, which, although they could include some general description of what one desired, would focus primarily on the designation of a surrogate, the name of the individual who could be spoken to and who would provide information as to what the individual would desire. The advantage in this, of course, is that that individual, hopefully someone that the person in question believed to have a similar value system to their own, would be able to assess complex and changing circumstances and apply them in accordance with what they believe that individual would truly want, and could do so in a fairly dispassionate way. It is difficult, of course, to find a person who can do this for many individuals, often for people in our society who find themselves without very many friends. This can apply, for example, to the elderly whose generation they find has passed away, who don't have very many close associates, whose family members may be distant from them or unavailable. And so the shift, unfortunately, has moved back in our day towards attempting to designate in a document what an individual desires. And the specific focus has been what would one desire at the end of life, not just in terms of general palliative care, but more specifically, would one desire to be resuscitated or not resuscitated given one's medical state. And the specific issue is an individual who is reaching the end of life, who has already decided that they do not wish to have certain kinds of resuscitative efforts attempted, such as intubation or the use of a respirator or the use of chest compressions or other invasive modalities. There may be individuals who have decided that under no circumstances would they want these things, and they might rightly fear that if they were taken to an institution where they were not known and where it was not possible to contact someone who would be able to speak for them, then their wishes would not necessarily be followed. So there has been an effort in a number of states to legislate into existence a document that would be different from the older advance directives, particularly different from the idea of a living will, in that it would record not just the individual's wishes, but also would specifically include the advice of and the recommendations of a physician. In other words, it would contain physician's orders, the kind of physician's orders that a physician might make if they were there themselves. And the notion behind this is that it can only be filled out by a licensed physician in the state where this document is issued. And of course, it must involve a discussion with the individual or with their surrogate decision maker. So it would reflect both the wishes of the patient and the concurrent agreement of a physician that that kind of treatment is accepted or is appropriate in the judgment of that physician. And the general name given to this kind of legislation is POLST, or POLST, and that stands for Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And this kind of document, which is increasing in popularity throughout the United States, varies a bit from state to state, but does have a kind of a generic sameness. So one cannot speak of an international POLST approach at this time, and unfortunately I'm forced to speak from the POLST legislation which I know best, which is that in California, which I've listed here on the webpage before you. But I can tell you that the issues that it raises and the general approach that is taken here is also characteristic of how it's being applied in other states. And the number of states that have instituted this kind of legislation are several, up to, I think, about 12 to 16 at present, and there are efforts ongoing to make its use more widespread. And in general, one finds that in the medical literature, it is strongly encouraged. Again, because it describes not only the patient's desires, but it also makes it clear that there has been a physician involved in these decisions. Now, there are issues, there are concerns about the POLST document, which we'll come to as we move along. But let's drop down on this webpage. The first section, highlighted in blue, is POLST intent, and here I've simply taken California law as a way of allowing us to look into the mind of the legislators, to get a sense of what it is that these people who are framing these laws believe they should do, or what it is they intend for them to accomplish. And intriguingly, here you will note that one of the first things that I've highlighted is that there is a reiteration, a restatement of the fact that existing law provides that a healthcare provider who honors a request to forego resuscitative measures is not subject to criminal prosecution, civil liability, discipline for unprofessional conduct, administrative sanction, or any other sanction as a result of his or her reliance on the request, provided that they meet certain requirements. So the first thing is to reassure healthcare professionals that honoring this kind of document will not get them into any trouble, into any legal or ethical trouble, either with the state or with their professional organizations. If we then move down to the section that's highlighted in white, it's intended to be signed by an individual who has capacity, who is able to make a decision for themselves, or if the person no longer has that ability or doesn't have that at this time, by a legally recognized healthcare decision maker and that individual's physician. So it's intended to be signed by the person's doctor and by the person themselves or by their designated surrogate. Notice if we drop down again to the next highlighted section, the bill, as they're intending it, would require a healthcare provider to treat an individual in accordance with the POLST form. And here is one of the problems that the medical community, particularly physicians, face when they are encountering a POLST. Certainly, it is a very clear statement of the patient's wishes. The patient has gone to the trouble, or their surrogate has gone to the trouble, of not only expressing what they want, but discussing it with a doctor who concurred. But physicians' orders are not universally binding. That is to say, the idea of a physician's orders is something that applies only in the institution where the physician has privileges. The license to practice medicine in a state does not confer the right to write orders in any institution in the state except those where the physician has applied for and been granted privileges. And the right or the honor of having medical privileges means that the institution has taken the trouble to assess the competence of that individual to practice. So the trouble with a POLST is that you don't know who's written this document, nor do you know their qualifications, their competence, the nature of their relationship with the patient. All you know is that if it's valid, that person has a license to practice medicine in the state. So although the legislators want this to be something that would be binding, they also had to recognize, and this is the next section here, except as specified, and here's the specification, this legislation would permit a physician to conduct an evaluation of the individual and issue a new order consistent with the most current information available about their health status and goals of care. So on the one hand, the whole legislation, the whole idea of this document is to prevent the horrible specter of someone finding themselves in an institution where they aren't known and being forced to undergo all sorts of treatment that they wouldn't want. But on the other hand, one has to recognize that the decision to initiate treatment is made by physicians on the basis of what they judge the patient's condition to be. One could imagine, for example, someone who was severely depressed, who became suicidal, who believed themselves to be at the end of life, who had a not very sympathetic or a competent physician, or maybe the individual was sympathetic to the idea of their having the right to end their life, even though there was no such thing as physician-assisted suicide in the state. And so one ended up with a pulse filled out by someone who was not actually suffering from a terminal illness and who suddenly required care for something that was eminently treatable by relatively minimal but perhaps slightly invasive techniques. Physicians would be faced with the terrible prospect of a document that seemed to compel them to do something that would be radically against everything that they had believed in and trained for. So effectively, although the document wants to be a requirement, nevertheless, it has to allow for these exceptions. It has to allow for physicians who are very concerned about perhaps the inappropriateness or some other aspect of this kind of a document to be able to reevaluate the patient and conceivably write different kinds of orders. So although it certainly represents a very clear indication of patient wishes, it is not, at least in California and in the other states that I'm familiar with, as completely binding as to be an absolute requirement. Effectively, what the document is trying to do is to say, you won't be sued if you do what this document asks you to do. But are you absolutely obliged to do it? Well, no one can compel a physician to practice unorthodox or inappropriate medicine. So if that's what's being required by the document, the physician can't be required to do it. And that's one of the limitations of the POLST, which at the same time is something that many patient advocates do not realize and which perplexes them when it's pointed out to them. If we move down to section one, which is number two on the large blue bars, the highlighted section describes the legislature attempting to say that this complements advanced directives by effectively transforming the person's wishes into a medical order. And the hallmarks of this are immediately actionable signed medical orders on a standardized form, orders that address a range of life-sustaining interventions, as well as the patient's preferred intensity of treatment, a brightly colored, clearly identifiable form. At present, at least in most states that I'm familiar with, the color of this form is hot pink, so that it's very visible. It's supposed to be placed on the refrigerator or in a very prominent place in the home of individuals who have executed it, so that if emergency team individuals are called to the house, then they will see this and be able to act or not act appropriately. The goal is also item E4, that it be adopted and honored across treatment settings, and this is somewhat true. Certainly it's pretty much binding on all emergency medical personnel, but in terms of people who have a license to practice medicine, again, nothing can force you to practice medicine that is inappropriate or not according to accepted standards. So even a POLST can't compel a physician to do that. And finally, a description that this is particularly useful for individuals, and notice it says particularly useful but not completely limited or exclusively limited to people who are frail, elderly, have a compromised medical condition, a prognosis of 1 year of life, or a terminal illness. So this is primarily a document that is envisioned as a kind of a warning, please do not resuscitate in the case of someone who has reached the end of their life, but who may still be somewhat mobile and might find themselves traveling or in a setting where they are otherwise unknown. And in the next highlighted section, 3, the POLST legislation. If we drop down to the highlighted text and then further a little past it to section 4781.2 in the California Probate Code, notice that it says that a healthcare provider shall treat an individual in accordance with the POLST, but that does not apply if it involves medically ineffective healthcare or healthcare contrary to generally accepted healthcare standards. And this is applicable to the healthcare provider or institution. So standards that are in violation either of the institution's expectations or of the provider themselves. So physicians do have a certain amount of latitude as far as the POLST is concerned. And then if we drop down to number 4782, also highlighted, the goal would be that someone who follows a document like this is not subject to criminal prosecution. That hasn't actually been tested in California, but certainly no one's been convicted for following a POLST. And the last section, number 4, is the form itself, and I'd invite you to take a look at this at your leisure. There's an A, B, and a C, and a D sections that can be, the first sections are checked. An individual checks either attempt CPR or do not attempt CPR, and then there's an attempt to delineate further what kinds of comfort measures one wishes to use, or limited interventions, or if an individual wishes full treatment. And then one might ask the question, why are they filling out a POLST if they want full treatment? But in any case, that option exists on the form. And my point in looking at this is to simply make us aware of what is currently, as it were, in the works as the next thing that is supposed to enable patients' wishes to be more clearly respected and implemented in the context of healthcare. However, I think it should be noted that the gold standard in all of this is to have a living, breathing human being to speak to. And so no form, a POLST or any other kind of document, can ever take the place of a designated surrogate. So when in our parishes or in our interactions with one another or when we're working with family members or people who are asking our advice, the key should be, do not imagine that the POLST or any other form is going to guarantee that your wishes be carried out. The most effective and appropriate thing to do, in addition to those things, if one wishes to do them, is to designate and to have this designation clearly documented a person who can speak for one if one is no longer capable of speaking for oneself. And of course, this implies a relationship in which one has shared with that individual one's ethical point of view, one's processes in decision making, and the goals of therapy that one would normally want to have implemented. So again, I think we have to strongly emphasize in all of our dealings with, again, family, friends, or anyone else, that a designated surrogate is really the key and the most important thing for an individual to have. One might add parenthetically, of course, that within the Catholic context, it would be difficult to clarify in a document all the principles that one would want to have applied from the standpoint of Catholic bioethics, and that here too, designating someone whose faith commitment and whose commitment to the tradition and to the principles of ethical decision making that are proper to the Catholic Church would solve the problem of attempting to have to have some sort of a complicated ethical consult if the situation became complex. So attempting to simply write something like, I wish to act in accordance with the wishes of the Catholic Church, will be very difficult to interpret, particularly in a secular context, whereas designating a living, breathing human being who happens to share convictions in regard to Catholic bioethics would be an extremely effective way of making sure that one's wishes are followed.